I appreciate having opportunity to visit here. Very peaceful place. Forest monasteries. This is the Ajahn Chah was emphasizing the effect of nature on consciousness, just natural conditions that haven't been too much disrupted or changed by human greed, hatred, and delusion. So, this is the kind of theme of the forest monastic tradition, going off into the jungle or the forest or places, or, you know, in Christianity, it was the desert fathers going off into the desert, or places where say, human interference with natural conditions are minimal. And so, this course, if you've been brought up in cities, like I'm a city boy by nature, was brought up, lived in Seattle, grew up there, and lived mainly my lay life in cities. But when I ordained, of course, it was in forests. So I found, you know, because you have time to contemplate and reflect on your own experience of what's going on in your mind, I noticed how, you know, like one time at Chithurst, I went on a month retreat there, right, in the Hammer Wood. And then at the end of that, I had some appointment in London. So somebody picked me up in a car, and we were driving from Chithurst. And my mind was all, having lived in the forest for a month, was all very subdued and calm and peaceful. And then I just began to notice just the impingement of going through town, seeing people, advertisements, shops, the way people dress, and the closer you got into London, the more exciting it all became. And so London was like, you know, it's an exciting place, and it's built by human greed, hatred, and delusion. So, you know, even though it has beautiful parts and that in it, it's still human creations that are made up out of natural conditions, but are changed and formed according to our own likes and dislikes and desires. And so that has a different effect on the mind. Like, it tends to, you know, we tend to use things to excite or stimulate consciousness. And when you go into natural conditions like forests, or even sound of water, waterfalls, the sound of the sea, the tide, wind, rain, and all these are actually quite calming to our consciousness, because they're not, because they're just natural to this realm. Like, our bodies and our consciousness are natural. They're not created out of human ignorance and greed. So then when we say surrender to natural conditions, then we find ourselves in harmony with it, in a sense of peacefulness, calm, tranquility. And then, say, the city stands for the kind of ability for human beings to excite, stimulate, create greed. Even, you know, the way people talk now about stimulating the economy to, we're all consumers. We're not even people anymore. We're just big mouths. You you're not actually a person, you're a consumer. And they want you to consume as much as possible to make the economy progress and prosper. So that's what human values do. We have this idea of progress and advancement, and in nature's, the natural conditions that we don't create tend to be ignored or destroyed in the process. So we have all kinds of problems with pollution and environmental problems due to the human ignorance. So living in the forests in Thailand for 10 years, 11 years, and then going to live in a city like London for 2 years, Ajahn Vir Dhamma and I, it was quite an interesting transition from the forests of Southeast Asia to a huge, enormous European city. Now, the important thing is the way out of suffering is not, you know, is not to destroy or criticize or try to change things according to ideals we have, but to recognize, to wake up and observe how things are, because not many of us have the power or the ability to change the environment to the way we think it should be, or to influence the governments of our countries in a way that they would be in a line with Dhamma. So, but we can do it with ourselves. You see, this is where the groundwork takes place, knowing what you can do within the limitation that we're all in of being a human entity in a vast universe, and which, is marvelous, it's magical, it's fantastic, it's terrifying, and to the way we perceive it as a kind of vulnerable creature on the planet. And I think our vulnerability and our helplessness is even more emphasized under natural catastrophes like earthquakes and hurricanes, volcanoes and whatnot. These tsunamis, these things are, you can't blame on the government or on human greed. They're just the natural movement and change of phenomena. We also have used our intelligence to create very destructive weapons, which is very sad indeed that so much money and energy and intelligence goes towards destruction. And of course it's justified in the sense of protecting ourselves. And so there's all kinds of moral dilemmas now with, like, preemptive strikes. Do we have a right to strike, to invade, to destroy somebody or an enemy that looks like they're about ready to destroy us? And of course this would endless conversations and arguments about this. But the Buddha established the five precepts as a kind of moral agreement that we can that is not far out or impossible or terribly difficult, but just five precepts that we can agree to in order to live together and have some sense of social security within our group, our society, our families. So then these five precepts, can be refined, taken to finer levels, or they can be just presented in the more kind of coarse way of, like, the first precept of Bhanadibhad, not to intentionally kill another human being. And so that is the kind of basic requirement of the first precept. And then, of course, as we as we feel the need, we can say respect life more and more accordingly. But it is, but precepts are what we ask for. Like this, when I first went to live in London, there was is a 1977, and morality generally had a was a word we didn't use very much because everybody had this feeling that it was a kind of form of tyranny, and they always connected it with a Victorian morality, kind of a very black and white, condemning type of demand on others, and an imperative from above. And so, you know, that's religion in the West is very much about imperatives and commandments from above. And so that there is a big strong reaction, of course, against that, and this kind of freedom where morality was no longer an issue, but just this sense of freedom, being able to do without any kind of moral condemnation, and to kind of live your life and do all the things that before would have been morally condemned or would have been criticized. So there's this kind of, you know, sense of inspiration, freedom of the kind of hippie days and the sense of free and, you know, nobody can tell me what to do, no authority. I can say what I want and do what I want. And that has a certain kind of appeal, you know, especially when you're young. You like the idea of breaking away from the boundaries and restraints of your family and the society. At least I did. So that I can definitely understand it. But then in the Buddhist sense, morality is not an imperative. You know, it's not, you know, when the five precepts, we can't kind of make you, force you, or intimidate you into taking them, or we're not supposed to, anyway. So, you know, you're supposed to ask three times, according to the kind of formulaic Pali tradition, you have to ask three times. Even one time we can't do it. You ask three times. Well, this is a ceremony, but also makes a point of you're taking on those five precepts out of a sense of your own commitment, and it's not being out of being intimidated or frightened into doing it, but it is a kind of awakening process of growing and seeing the need for restraint in terms of action and speech. And this, of course, is what you call like growing up or maturing as a human being, where we take on responsibility for action and speech rather than just following impulse and or doing what everyone else is doing, and having no kind of agreements on behavior. So we all have the same kind of instinctive impulses to protect ourselves, and of course we're quite capable of murder and killing and deceit and lying and stealing, and we're all very good at that as human beings. And so this is not something, you know, that is outside our species. I mean, we're probably the most deceitful, murderous, and destructive species on the planet. But we also have this ability to make these moral agreements, such as the five precepts. So we have, you know, we can decide. It doesn't mean that we never feel like murdering, stealing, or lying, but it means that we are determined not to act on those impulses or those tendencies when they arise in our consciousness. Well, that's the gift of our humanity, because the animal kingdom doesn't have that ability to agree. Theirs are more, you know, survival of the fittest, and there their consciousness is influenced by their form and their genetic makeup, their species, so that they don't reflect on behavior. They don't have a sense of morality in the same way we do. They do have their own, you know, instincts and species tendencies, so salmon know where to go and birds know where to fly and things like that without going to a course on aviation or oceanography. Now, the gift of our humanity lies in this, is that we have the same instincts, we're quite destructive, but we can agree not to do those things. We still have those impulses, tendencies, but we can also determine not to act on them. So, in this sense, morality is not about, it's about action and speech, not about impulse or thought or emotions. I found when I was growing up, you know, as a Christian, I found it very confusing because the instruction I had was that even thoughts were, bad thoughts were immoral, or sexual thoughts were immoral, or hatred was immoral. And so you felt this frustration because you did feel a kind of hopelessness because you saw yourself with these, especially in puberty and in your relationships with others, anger and resentment, hatred and so forth arising. And you felt it was easy to take it very personally, as I'm a bad boy, I'm no good. I remember one time in public transportation in Seattle, my mother, you know, she was quite good at kind of giving me independence, so I could go into the city by myself and come back on the public transport. And I remember coming back one time, I must have been 9 years old or around that age, and basically my aspirations were to be a good person. But I was standing in a crowd of people on a trolley car, and suddenly I had this incredibly wicked desire. It was so evil, I'm not going to tell you what it was. That it shocked me so much. I thought, you know, well, only a really evil person could think such a thing. You know, there'd be something really bad about me. And it frightened me because I'd never had such a thought before. And then how it could have entered consciousness, I don't know. But it happened, and it shocked me. So, it, you know, this sense of fear arising from evil forces, or maybe I have, you know, something wrong in myself, some evil demon or that inside that will maybe come out and take over, control me, so that these kind of paranoia fears would arise. So in Buddhism, what appealed to me was the fact that morality was about action and speech, because this we can. We have choices about, usually. We can't help some of the impulses or thoughts and feelings that arise in consciousness, but whether we act and speak on them, that's where the choice is. And so it's to do good and refrain from doing bad. The law of karma, do good, you receive good, do bad, you receive bad. Now this is, like in Thailand, for example, this is just kindergarten basic. Every Thai child knows do good, receive good, do bad, receive bad. Probably in Sri Lanka the same thing. I mean, it's just part of a cultural basic cultural conditioning. But in the West, it wasn't that clear. Like, we have this idea that it's the end. If you have a good end, you sometimes have to use violent means to have a peaceful end, such as the invading of Iraq to bring democracy, using tyrannical violent means to bring democracy. Or in the Soviet Union, when you read Marx's books on communism, and you think this is a very grand ideal, of using everything in common. There's no rich, no poor, everything's equal, everything's shared. It's how things should be as an ideal. But then the means used to promote communism was tyranny. So it ends up as a tyranny. And, just contemplate this in your own life. If you want a peaceful life, you can't use kind of aggressive, selfish means to have a peaceful mind. It just is impossible. And so you can't kind of command peace and then punish people for not being peaceful. And so this is where, the Buddha's emphasis was on finding that within yourself. Like during the early 60s, when I was in the university in Berkeley, I was a kind of interested in peace activism and joined peace movement groups of the early 60s. And we used to protest, the Atomic Energy Commission and things like this. And as you got involved in these peace organizations, you began to realize they were anything but peaceful themselves. And there's a lot of, blame and resentment going on within them, and competition and jealousies. And then I looked at myself and I saw that, I wasn't peaceful. And my mind was always full of fear and worry, anxiety, jealousies, envy, and so forth. So even though I liked the idea of peace, and I was demanding that the society be peaceful, I wasn't. So I began to think, I'm a hypocrite. This is hypocrisy. So I don't even know what I'm talking about. I just like the idea of peace. And but I don't know what it is. So then I was in this graduate program on South Asian cultural studies. And the first seminar I had that year was on Mahatma Gandhi. And so I was in a seminar, graduate seminar, in which there were about 10 people in this. And the lecturer was quite a well-known woman called Joan Bondurant, who'd written, who had been with Mahatma Gandhi in the 40s and worked in the Gandhian movement. And she'd written a book called The Conquest of Violence. Of course, Gandhi was assassinated in 47, but anyway, this was in 1962. So anyway, she was a very impressive person, I thought, And she actually knew, you know, had worked with him and had studied it and had a PhD and all that. And then out of the other graduate students in this seminar, I began to see that they were all eager to find fault with Gandhi. You know, the graduate student mind in, you know, is to, you know, he presents himself as kind of a saint and a peaceful person, but then, you know, they want to prove that it was, maybe it was a hypocrite or he wasn't what he said. And Dr. Joan Bondron and myself tended to be more devotees. Because I was very inspired by Gandhian teaching. And the thing that inspired me so much was his, Gandhi's autobiography was called My Experiments with Truth. And at this time, you know, I was, you know, the life in a free-wheeling community like Berkeley, California at that time, and the sense of, you know, marijuana smoking was becoming fashionable, and there were all kinds of, you know, there's a very free kind of liberal community to live in. And so I was studying a lot, but also I could see in my own way I was kind of sinking into just kind of passive getting through the system habits. And then I thought, you know, well, Gandhi, you know, he says, my experiments with truth, he was using his whole life as an experiment. And suddenly I thought, that's really admirable to use your life as an experiment. Imagine. And then I looked at my life, and then I was thinking, and then we used to complain about the American government all the time. And so I heard myself one day saying, why can't we produce people like Gandhi in America? Why do we always produce such mediocre leaders? And then an inner voice said, why don't you try? And then emotional reaction was, oh, no, not me. No, I And then I saw, you know, here I was going around saying, you should do it. You know, the American government, the American president, the American political system, or somebody else. And so, what was I doing? Just kind of slinking by in a system that was easy to get through without any great effort. So, that made a strong impression. And so after my finished my degree there, I joined the Peace Corps and then went off and became a monk 2 years later. Because that was the one thing that I really found inspired me was Buddhism. I didn't know how to do anything, you know, I had no other real interest. But the one kind of, the light at the end of the tunnel, I think I was in a state of depression or something at the time, was there was still this interest in Buddhism. And of course, being in Southeast Asia, Thailand was the easiest place to get to to study Buddhism. So this is like an experiment with one's life. And so over the, I ordained as a seminarian in 1966, and in 1967 as a bhikkhu, and that's when I met Ajahn Chah, and so that's over 40 years of an experiment with my and of course it is a, you know, I'm very pleased with the result because it is, for me, the teaching of the Buddha is through my own investigation of it and use of it. You know, it's you get the results that he says you will if you do it. I mean, it's not a highfalutin kind of ethereal, metaphysical goal you're after that is, you know, you have to be a specially born kind of higher being to get it. And so it says it's for, you know, Deva Manusanang, which is like ethereal beings, and Manusya, which are human beings. I can't relate to being a Deva or an ethereal being. That does not, in any way, even my most kind of conceited tendencies, have ever thought myself in those perceptions. But human beings, yes, this is this I can relate to as a concept that best describes me and my life on this planet. And of course, this then this process of sila, samadhi, panya, of sila as a as a foundation, so that we, you know, this is like we actually, the physical forms that we're in with their tendencies, like sexual desire, this is a natural desire to the species. You know, we wouldn't be here without it. And it's, you know, it is what it is. It's part of the package of this form of mammalian creatures of the animal realm, and it so therefore it's not the problem. Sexual desire, tendency towards aversion and anger, these are primal emotions that you see in animals. And it's the protective system of having fear and anger or aversion. So we begin to contemplate that in terms of action and speech, you know, as human, as minutia, as human beings, we determine to take on the responsibility to do good and refrain from doing bad. But in terms of mental states, we still have to deal with lust and the results of our own personal tendencies and anger and aversion and fear and ignorance and desire. And so then, so this is a foundation, just a basic agreement on behavior, like in the monastic form, Bhikkhu Vinaya, gives us an agreement on behavior, action and speech, which makes it possible to live as a group, you know, that even though in many ways as individuals we would never live together or get along very well, we can live together due to the structures that we've agreed upon. So I found it like the first years of training were with Thai monks. And of course that was all learning language, learning all kinds of things. And I found, you know, after a few years, I kind of knew how to live with them. And because I was the only foreigner there, you know, then I didn't have a lot of to do with, you know, they didn't expect me to really get involved in the same way as if I were a Thai monk, because I couldn't speak the language very well. And I was just mainly interested in meditation. And then about the fourth year, then suddenly Western people started coming, and that started creating a lot of problems for me. And I found it much easier to live with Thai monks than with Americans. So, because Americans would bring up, you know, a lot of things that Thais wouldn't. So then I found that quite, you know, at first I out of good heartedness wanted to encourage them, but also at the same moment kind of dreaded having them around. Because then by that time, I could speak the language well enough where I had to be translator. Well, one thing with Thais, you know, they because they are Buddhist by culture, there's a lot you don't have to explain. They just kind of assume. So, but when you get these kind of pesky Western people coming, they're always full of questions, you know. Why do you have to do this? What's the point of that? Why do we have to perform these ceremonies? What's the point of chanting? The Buddha never chanted, and the Buddha didn't have Buddha images, and you get all these views and opinions that you never get from, usually, very seldom from any Thai monk. And it was like trying to, first tendency to defend or justify or whatever, try to explain everything. Felt frustrated because I didn't particularly like being in that position. And eventually, after my fifth vasa, after 5 years, you're called a navaka, or you're supposed to stay with your teacher for 5 years. And then after 5 years, the amount of Western monks was increasing, and the fifth vasa was an absolute nightmare for me. I took about four or five Western monks with me up to a branch monastery in a place called Amnat Chilern. And Ajahn Chah was at the main monastery, and I invited Ajahn Liam, who's now the official head monk at Wat Pah Phong. He came with me, and we spent the vasa at this place called Tham Sang Pat. And during that vasa, everything went wrong. One monk went mad. Another one was, I had been in Sri Lanka, and is German, and everything we did was compared to Sri Lanka, and always it wasn't good enough. So I had to deal with him, his complaints, and plus all kinds of other questions and difficulties, and I was so fed up that after that vasa, I needed to renew my passport anyway, so I had an excuse, went to Bangkok with the intention of not going back. And so the sixth vasa, I found another monastery in central Thailand, and then I went off to India. And so I determined to... I wanted to go to India because that's where the Buddha originated, and I wanted to see if you could live as like the Buddha did in his time. So somebody in Bangkok gave me and another monk a return ticket from Bangkok to Calcutta. So I remember getting off the plane at Calcutta and suddenly realizing this was at the time when the war in Bangladesh, when it separated from Pakistan, and Calcutta was a nightmare scenario of, you know, refugees living out on the pavements. You actually see people dying, and it was and suddenly I realized, you know, here I am with an alms bowl, no money, another beggar in a country that has too many beggars already. And so this, thinking like this in this very personal way, you know, it terrified me. I think this was a really stupid thing to be doing. But then, you know, I wasn't, you know, I didn't have money, so I needed to beg in some way, at least have an alms ball. And then also, I kept reflecting on that this was, that we weren't going to go around, you know, hassling anybody. We just had to see what would happen. So, fortunately, Buddhist monks, even in India, have seemed to survive very well because the Mahabodhi Society in Calcutta took me in, and they arranged bindabhatas for me, for the other monk. We'd go, and he'd arrange special houses of Bengali Buddhists to give us dana every day. And so, actually, we were in Calcutta in a very nice vihara. And around us, of course, was pretty grim. But then we, you know, from there we traveled. I was in India for over 5 months, just living on alms. And during that time, and I went to the Buddhist holy place like Bodhgaya and Nalanda, Rajagir and Varanasi, and even to Savatthi and Lumpini. And then we met, we stayed in various viharas or in Hindu temples or just shelters. Because in India, you know, even though we were Buddhist monks, they have great respect for what they call sadhus or holy men. So, you know, it was a real adventure, actually, because we had, you know, sometimes barely enough to eat, and sometimes we were, banquets were given for us. Some Brahmins in the city of Kanpur gave us vegetarian banquets every day for about 10 days. Here, you know, these got wealthy Brahmins suddenly took an interest in us. And then they wanted philosophical discussions. and then we met, you know, like Mahabodhi monks. There's in also the remainder of Buddhism from the ancient times is in Bengal, of course, where there's the Bengali Buddhists, which also in Bangladesh. And they trace their lineage back to the time of the Buddha. They have, you know, so they see themselves as the remnants of what is left of the original Buddhism in India. So that was, but during that time in India, I had this strong sense of thinking of gratitude towards Lungpa Cha, because he did give me this training and accept me as a disciple and you know, the teaching was very direct and very practical. And suddenly I felt this gratitude arise. Well, this was like a very heart-opening experience. Where before, say, so much of my practice was motivated by willfulness and pretty much sense of me trying to attain. So I could only go so far with that, with just my kind of ambition and willful tendencies. And even though my desires to attain were certainly good desires, you know, it wasn't really liberating. In the sense that I was still, there was still this tension and everything was filled with sense of myself. Then in India, of all places, this experience of gratitude, Katanyu, Gatavati in Pali, it was like something opened here, you know, instead of coming from up here, the heart kind of opened up. And I felt this incredible sense of rapture. And so my only intention after that was go back to Thailand and in some way be of use to Lung Pon Chai. I thought, how can you repay a teacher? You know, doesn't want money. So I thought I'd go back and be a good disciple, and whatever he asked me to do, I'll do. So, where before that, a lot of things he asked me to do, I didn't want to do. And I did run away, kind of cowardly, getting out of the way. So I went back, and by this time, Ajahn Weerdhammo had arrived at Wat Phappo. From that time on, my intention was to do what Lung Po Cha was, support him in some way, not to be a troublesome disciple to him, because he had plenty of those. I mean, Thai Buddhism is not that great either, you know. So there's always problems in any sangha. So anyway, he eventually had me establish Wat Nana Chat. It's about the last thing I ever wanted to do. So the very thing that I didn't want to do, I've been doing now for... And then going to live in the UK. I never thought of going to live there. But it happened, conditions arose, and Lung Po Cha asked me to go. So but it was done not, it wasn't with a grudging tendency or just doing it out of duty, because the Kadanyu experience was something awakened in me that was what you call on a heart level. Before, so much of my Buddhism was intellectual and ideal, and came from that level, from the head and then the heart, and then the physical, the body, was limited by the Vinaya. So this was this Sila Samadhi Panya process. So in monastic life, I found, you know, like living in monastic communities, and in Thailand or in England, you have, you know, your vipaka kamma arises, you know. So you, like in this perception of vipaka kamma, is that like even in the scriptures, the Buddha had his vipaka kamma, and so even though he was enlightened, he still was subject to all kinds of blame and troubles and problems that arose around him, that he had to deal with, such as Devadatta in that marvelous play we saw. And then... And, you know, drunken elephants, they had to deal with that. Never had that problem. And we've had, you know, but it's vipaka kamma. You have your own karma to deal with, whatever that may be. And, of course, in my own experience, I found this concept very useful. Because, think, why is this happening? Why does this have to happen to me? And then, it's my vipaka kamma, and somehow just that makes me accept it. You know, it's just the way it is. You know, it's why me kind of thing doesn't make any sense anymore. This is something I learned from. I have to, you know, whether I like it or not is not the issue. It's what is happening now, and this is the way I'm feeling about it. Or my own emotional reaction to the conditions that I'm experiencing is like this, or physical conditions like old age and various. Fortunately, I've been, you know, fairly strong constitution, so I haven't had a lot of unbearable pain or illnesses to live with. Like some monks and nuns have endless problems with their bodies and disease and physical disabilities. But in terms of this conflict between, because usually these things are at odds with each other, the physical, the emotional, and the intellectual. So you have this intellect which knows what's right and what's wrong and what's good and what's bad, and then you've got these emotions that don't seem to have any sense of right or wrong, good or bad. And then you've got a body that is like this. You know, it's got these energies, sexual energies, it's got, you know, pain and pleasure, and it's constantly being impinged on by the sensory world around. You're constantly being irritated, and then you have to move, just sit, stand, walk, lie down, breathe. Heat and cold, hunger, thirst, and all the rest. You know, just think of having the whole process of having to take care of the needs of your body through a lifetime. So this is an ongoing, you know, part of the vipakakama of having human birth. And then in terms of relating in the Sangha or to lay people, the liking, disliking, preferring one over another, the jealousies, the envies, the fears, the intimidations, the reactions that one emotionally has to living in communities with people. That at least you're morally kind of together, you know, you've agreed on that level. But you can be, you know, Amravati is international, so you've got people from different cultures, different age groups, and living together in which many ways one culture might not particularly, you know, we find. Like we found when the Iron Curtain disappeared and Eastern Europeans started coming. You know, they look just like Western Europeans, but some of their reactions aren't. So it's easy to make judgments, you know, how they should or shouldn't be. But the thing is that, you know, on the level of Sila or Vinaya, we have a common agreement. Emotionally, we can't. We just have to be aware of our own personal reactions to the impingement and the conditions we're experiencing. Intellectually, we're conditioned in usually very dualistic attitudes of right and wrong, good and bad, true and false. And so, like from my background, being brought up as a Christian, you have this sense of almost absolute right and wrong. It's very, you know, this: if it's right, it's true, and if it's true, it's right. And it has to be, and there's no difference between true and right. And so there's kind of logic there. But then this conundrum of Lungpa Cha's true but not right, right but not true, is another one that kind of challenges your intellect. Because if you've already been conditioned in this very dualistic way, then you don't know how to work with paradoxes or with other ways of looking. You know, you're used to absolutizing extremities, and then they're the best, and then anything lesser is a kind of weakness or something not as good as. So like compromising can seem like weakness, and modifying or something. So I found in my tendency with vineyard to always think the most strict, the most extreme interpretation was right, because that's how my intellect operates. And even though emotionally, I found that put me in a state of emotional stress, because always trying to live up to high principles and standards of right and true as a human individual, and expecting others to, led to endless feelings of guilt and frustration and with myself, with the people I'm living with. And so then you realize that the Buddha, his emphasis was on mindfulness, sati sampatthana and panya. And so beginning to get this dualistic thinking process in perspective from the level of panya. And so one day I remember, before going to England, I was in Bangkok for some reason. And suddenly I had this insight into, I have this tendency to want to be magnanimous as a person. And I want to be liberal and magnanimous and fair about everything. I've got this ideal. And yet, personally, when people ask me about religion, I wanted to say all religions are, they're all pointed at the same thing. They're just different approaches. And, I'm being incredibly tolerant and broad-minded. This is what you do at faith meetings. And then emotionally, I felt differently. So this is just getting to know. Now, that which is aware of my own emotional feeling and my ideal feeling, that is sati sampatthana. I discerned it. It's not saying that, it's not taking sides with any of it, but it gives you this perspective on your actual emotional, what you're experiencing emotionally and the ideals and that you might be having about yourself or the society you live in. So in the UK, it's a culture there that is very critical culture. So it's, and the criticism also is towards oneself. I found in that people are very self-disparaging there, tendencies towards being obsessed with their faults. And so, and then they don't like any kind of megalomania or boasting. So, anyone that says, I'm the greatest in the world, that's no way to operate in the UK. If you say, well, you play the modest role. I'm just an ordinary person like you. Or, you even make yourself, well, I'm not, I'm not really as good as you are, kind of thing. But these are cultural tendencies, the conflict between Americans and the English, because Americans love superlatives. They come and they just, we're the greatest in the world, and of course, that is a way to really offend the British. Because even though they think they're the greatest in the world, they would never say it. Because they also have a kind of conceit of superiority of being British. So, they are English especially. So these are cultural conditions conditioning. And that which can be aware of that is sati sampajanya. And anyway, I had this insight about, I wanted to have this grand view of all religions being the same, pointing to the same place. And then my emotion, I said, but actually, Theravada Buddhism is better. That's how I felt emotionally. and then my magnanimous brain said, no, don't say that. don't let anyone know you see actually what you're thinking. And then I saw what I was doing. You know, it wasn't taking sides. And this is, then you're actually, you know, it's not a matter of Theravada being better or worse than any other religion, but, or, you know, having to align these in some kind of, first 10 religions and how they rank, who's first and who's 10th. But it's none of my business. But then in terms of I don't know, in terms of the what I've chosen, what inspired me or what interested me was originally Buddhism, and then because of conditions arising, living in Southeast Asia, I became Theravadan Buddhist. And so this is the tradition that I've used as quite intentional. It wasn't forced on me or anything. It was a deliberate choice. And then, so it's like, it's something you know how to use. You know, I've spend enough time investigating, using, experimenting with it to feel confident in the use of this particular tradition. And to me it is like a precision tool. I found it, you know, if you really follow that, like the Four Noble Truths, those essential teachings, they really can root out all ignorance. You know, they take you right down to the pure awareness level, in which is before you start becoming a person or a Canadian or a man or woman or anything else. And this, of course, is, and even before Buddhism itself. And so it's, you're getting right into natural phenomena, consciousness that is not created out of human ignorance. And so then the natural state that, you know, when we live amongst, like living here at Dhisarana, and a very nice kuti that they've allotted me, is you're surrounded by trees and water and a lot of insects. Some of and not all of it's great, the insects. We love to not have the insects, but they're also a part of it too, because they're part of this environment, and they are what they are, and our relationship to them is a non-violent one, even though one feels emotionally violent sometimes. but then there's a choice of action or non-action. Or an action which just maybe warns them not to get too close or go away, I don't want you here, is fair enough. Now this is, then you're aligning this with the natural conditions of the body. Your body's a natural condition. Consciousness is natural, it's Dhamma. The artificial conditions are this ego, cultural conditioning, all the conditioning process, the language that we have, our views and opinions, all these are created by human beings. So there's nothing wrong or, you know, we're not saying that to get rid of them, but to see them. To get outside the conditioning process that we tend to be so strongly identified with and bound into, and of course is the cause of our suffering, our lack of understanding, our inability to see things from the level of wisdom, but merely operating through personal tendencies, habits that have formed through identities with illusions. So in this way, the Buddha's pointing is back to nature. Let's get back to nature. Not necessarily a Buddhist statement, but also in terms of Dhamma. Dhamma is what's natural, isn't it? It's in Thai, the Thai language, the word for nature is Dhammacha, natural conditions. So this is like informing oneself of what is natural, what is not me, not mine. The body is not really me. It's a condition in nature, and the consciousness, that which claims to be me is my thinking process, my emotions, and my intellect. Now, in Vipassana meditation, then we are actually putting those into perspective. I've seen them from wisdom. They're conditions arising, ceasing. All conditions are impermanent. And so that puts us into that unborn, uncreated, that point of awareness that we have access to, where we see from the wisdom level rather than from the vipakakamma reactive level that we tend to operate from. So I'll stop here.
Antamayang tamo wada kata satu kalang tatamase.